This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. PostWrestlingCafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
And welcome, everybody, to another edition of Pollock and Thurston. I am John Pollock alongside Brandon Thurston. On today's show, we are going through the status, the state of AEW. I know everyone was looking at that graphic, Brandon. What are you trying to, lead people with these emojis that you used on this? Because I found that, I mean, we had a equal distribution of emojis here to replicate the potential outcomes of this AEW fan survey that we're going to break down a little later on with Jesse Collins.
As people may notice, if you're watching on YouTube, the graphics team put together a thumbnail for today's podcast. Now, the graphics team originally did not have the I don't want to say which way what mistakes they were making, but I set them straight and I said, no, this has to have an even number, an exactly equal number of sad faces and happy faces. There's going to be no bias here. You're not going to put forward your agenda here on this program. So you can count them for yourself. There are four sad faces. There are four happy faces. There are three neutral faces. So it's okay to be neutral too.
Okay, you can be neutral as well on this topic. So, yes, a little later on, Jesse Collins is going to join us because he has conducted this this really interesting fan survey that he got about 800 responses to, going through all of these various questions that he asked the AEW fan base about. So we're going to talk a little bit about what this survey says. Obviously, it's a very, I found interesting read to look at. It's certainly going to probably be an audience that is pretty engaged into professional wrestling that is responding to this. But I still feel you can glean a lot from some of the data that Jesse was able to pour through here. And we'll break down some of these.
It'll make for an interesting podcast nonetheless. 801 responses, but he does note in the article, he's aware that this is a hardcore representation of the fan base here.
Also, we are going to be talking about the latest movement on the Janelle Grant case as they are looking to push that forward. AEW planning to take over Texas during All In Week in July. We've got UFC and Meta coming together. We've got viewership stats, all that and more. But let's dive into things first and foremost. And well, let's start off actually with the Janelle Grant case, because this came out last week and we do have a story up on the site at postwrestling.com. Janelle Grant and her team are now looking to start the discovery process in their lawsuit. And what was the response from the defendants? Were they all unanimous in stating, you know what, this case has gone on long enough. Let's take things to the next step. Let's open up our documents and records for Janelle Grant's case. Was that how the defendants responded to this, Brandon?
No. So we don't have a response from the defendants as part of the court filings yet. But what was included in Grant's new filing are some email exhibits between Grant's attorneys and the defendant's attorneys. And it should be no surprise to anyone who's been following this closely enough that the defendants don't want to do discovery. And for anybody who doesn't know, discovery is when you start to allow the other side to look at your records, look at your documents, maybe email records. They want video security, security video. They want travel records involving Vince and John Laurinaitis and Brock Lesnar. Depositions would be a part of discovery. The defendants are pushing this into arbitration, trying to get this entire case to go into arbitration because they know that there's this arbitration clause that's part of the NDA that's central to this case. And so they argue that, hey, this entire thing Well, they're probably going to argue, and that's what they're alluding to. This entire thing could go to arbitration, which is a private process, not a part of public court. And why start discovery now and cost, and take on all the costs for the court and for the attorneys of doing discovery when that, you know, that might have to be repeated in private arbitration. So it's just the more cost effective thing to do. It's the fairer thing to do, and it would save everybody money unless it doesn't go to arbitration.
What would be the purpose of Janelle Grant's team pushing this forward at a point when the ruling hasn't been made by Judge Russell yet? We still have this amended complaint that still has to be accepted by the judge. Like, is this like, was there any strategy of this being accepted by the defendants, or do you look at this as like a strategic method of trying to be more aggressive just in terms of moving this case forward?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know exactly what the strategic thought is. Clearly, I mean, Grant wants this to stay in public court, and she wants a continued court case that involves all the discovery that they want. They want everybody to see exactly what happened here, and for the defense, it's the opposite. I mean, do you see any obvious strategy here?
Well, I think that it is, nonetheless, I think this does tie to when
pressure
the state
to settle or put some whatever leverage over the defendant, especially if the judge does agree. I mean, what WWE doesn't want, what Vince doesn't want, and Lauren Ice doesn't want is more references. You like discovery as part of filings necessarily. You might get some of it as exhibits, but you don't want all that stuff to be public. And the more, you know, that's negative for them. And that's leverage, I suppose, for a settlement, even though, you know, as all litigants are, they're not, you know, openly open to a settlement.
Yeah, and there is a portion in this filing that reads, plaintiff's counsel, after consultation with their clients, certify that A, they have discussed the nature and basis of her claims and possibility for achieving a prompt settlement or other resolution of the case, and B, they have developed the following proposed case management plan, which they outline as a kind of theoretical timetable to go through the next process. But of course, the defendants are believing that that is premature. And I would argue that the defendants do have a substantial argument here that this has not been ruled upon yet by the judge if this even should be moving forward. So that is a reasonable, I think, pushback from the defense here. But
the answer to all this is, it's how do you interpret the federal rules of civil procedure? I think that's going to have a lot to do with it. And that's where I just go, I don't know. And it seems to be different in every jurisdiction, even at the federal level. Far as like, is it proper now for there to be discovery at this point, despite the fact that the judge still has not ruled on the motions to compel arbitration, has not ruled on whether this amended complaint is going to be the operative complaint in the lawsuit going forward?
Yes. So until Judge Russell decides to decide, this is sort of just in limbo unless a settlement occurs. And if the defense just feels that this is the time to ramp up that discussion, we've talked about this almost in circles at this point of like what you're looking to get out of this specifically. Like, I think for WWE and John Laurinaitis, you just want this to be ended and move on. With Vince McMahon, I think there's more than just making this go away. It's restoring your reputation, I think, is the key to all of this for Vince McMahon. And will a settlement be viewed as such that he will feel that he can move forward with whatever it is he wants to launch next and get out of this whole process?
Yeah. And I mean, to that end, if you want to restore your reputation, is that going to happen in arbitration? It would seem not, but maybe there's a defamation lawsuit that Vince could file. But that would seem to bring a lot of what they don't want public, but in any case, as far as when the judge rules, I did have somebody ask me, you know, how long is it going to take before the judge rules? Now has to rule on three different things. It appears arbitration, the amended complaint, whether or not that's a go or they stay with the old one, and what we're talking about here, which is discovery. Judges generally have no timeline, no deadline about when they have to make their decisions, but I understand there is some 6-month period where they have to like file a report, and there is some sort of soft pressure there that you have to make a decision on pending motions within 6 months. So we'll be waiting.
As the closest thing we have to an unofficial lawyer, that being you, Brandon.
I
feel you can make these decisions. Like I could dedicate, you know, I'm going to take the entire day on Friday to go through this case, and I think by Monday I could decide on all these things.
You'd have to read a lot of them. Yeah, you have to read a lot of case law. You'd have to, you know, read, and maybe we would finally understand the federal rules of procedure.
Okay, well, we will continue to monitor this as it moves forward. WWE launched on Netflix in India beginning this past Monday, even got a mention on the broadcast by Michael Cole, because it was technically April 1st by the time this aired in India on Monday. And this ends WWE's longstanding relationship with Sony and its various partners since 2002 that they go back to. Their last agreement commenced in March of 2019, a five-year deal that expired this past week and was somewhere in the neighborhood roughly of like $200 million it was worth over those 5 years. And
yes, so they had 40 to 50, I think, is the prevailing wisdom. There's no official confirmation on the record by the parties about that. But yeah, it was what, 2020 through now, through the other day.
Yeah. They signed this agreement like right in the middle. It was not 2019. It was 2020 that they signed this, like right as the pandemic was beginning. They signed this big extension to their Sony deal. But
which was roughly double from the prior deal, which I believe was around 28 million a year.
And during this like last 5 year period, we definitely saw some of those initiatives. They built up to that superstar spectacle that they taped from the PC, which was really interesting because I just pulled up that card today to look at it. And the Indian talent that they had on that card: Jinder Mahal, the Bollywood Boys, Serena Sandhu, Jeet Rama, Shanky. Do you remember the dancing Shanky? Giant Zanjeer. And Guru Raj. You know what all of these performers have in common, Brandon? Besides,
they're no longer with WWE.
Ding, ding, ding. They're all gone from the company during this stretch when, you know, India had been one of those, the famous global localization map that Paul Levesque introduced to us years and years ago. India was definitely had one of those NXT flags on it. They did send out Nick Khan to promote this big move and was asked about the idea of bringing a premium live event to India. And he said that we're penciling that out for 2026 and 2027 in one of our first meetings with Netflix after the deal was signed. Without asking, Netflix handed us a list of their priority countries. At the top of that list was India. And knowing that the race would come into play on April 1st in India, if it's important to Netflix, assume it's important to us. India has always been important to us, so we're penciling it out now, and let's wait and see. So the pencils are out. Pencils come with erasers, but interesting to note there, the priority that India is for Netflix, where Netflix is not does not have a huge footprint in India. I believe it has about 12 million subscribers in India, and I guess they are looking at WWE as potentially being a area that they can grow that subscription in a part of the world that they are do not have that dominance in.
Yeah, this is one of the issues we should probably talk about more, is that Netflix is an amazing, shiny brand that everybody's, you know, especially in the U.S., it is the winner of the streaming wars in different geographies. It's for WWE, it is a step up in reach. I think for the U.K., that would be correct, right? Given that they were on BT Sport, which was UK wrestling fans, come on out and correct us. I believe BT Sport had lower reach versus what Netflix would have in that country. But here, in the case of Sony, I believe Sony's reach is greater than Netflix.
So we will see what the plans are for India and you know, being able to make that a big focus of kind of where Netflix is.
And just to mention, The notion of doing a big event, a big premium live event in India, they have experimented. It's a huge population. I would venture to guess this is probably the population with the biggest WWE audience. However, you would mention that just because of the sheer population of India. I mean, it's far greater than the U.S. or really any other country where WWE has a significant presence. But the median income in India is just not what it is in other countries like the United States or like the European countries that they've done PLEs in before. So it's probably why we have not seen a major event, televised event anyway, in India to this point. But if it's important to your biggest TV partner, which is now Netflix, then it's important to you.
Ring Ka King. Maybe that's the glory period of yes, pro wrestling in India.
Another one of Jeff Jarrett's achievements.
All right, let's talk about AEW. They have announced a week of events that will be taking place in Texas in the lead up to All In at Globe Life Field. So they have announced that July 9th and 10th, they will be doing Dynamite and Collision on back-to-back nights at the Curtis Culwell Center in Garland, Texas. That will be followed by ROH's Death Before Dishonor at the Esports Stadium that they did their residency in last summer. That will be on the Friday night, the night before All In, and accompanying this will be the return of StarCast over Friday and Saturday at the Sheraton in Arlington as they are preparing for their big week in Texas. And that Saturday, they will be going up against a Saturday night's main event as well. So this is the big battle that I would think they have not announced this officially, but it would certainly, you know, you would assume here that Collision will be live on the Thursday right after Dynamite as well. So as not to collide with, obviously, All In being on the Saturday.
Well, you would never want Collision to collide with something. This is the only event, is the ROH event that's going to be at Esports Stadium, it looks like.
That's all they've announced so far. So I don't know if this will be followed by anything else, because you had reported the fact that they had blocked out dates.
They were inquiring about a range of dates that would have encompassed the All-In Stadium event. Yes, but it's interesting to see that they have booked Curtis Culwell Center and not, you know, they're not going to do these events at Esports Stadium.
Yes, and
is this the most? Oh no, they're going to do Supercard of Honor. So this is not the most upcoming Ring of Honor pay per view, correct?
Yeah, they've got Supercard of Honor May 2nd, and that will be followed by this Death Before Dishonor. And it seems like it's now permanent that these ROH events are no longer going to be pay per views. They're just strictly for ROH subscribers on the streaming service, which is
premium live events. Premium live events.
They are premium live events. Yeah. When we get into this fan survey, we'll see about all the ROH fans that are out there that are, you know, just craving more AEW adjacent product as well. Did you wake up to see any images of Dana White and Mark Zuckerberg, you know, hand in hand announcing the allegiance between the UFC and Meta for this big partnership?
I did see that in my inbox this morning. Lo and behold, yeah. they've furthered their relationship.
Yes, two bros coming together. UFC has entered into a multi-year partnership with Meta, the tech Goliath that owns three of the largest social media platforms. Yes, I love exclusivity on platforms. The deal plans to integrate a wide variety of Meta products into UFC programming. That would come via the company's use of Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, Threads, or Meta AI. Do you think that they'll be utilizing Signal more now that it's been so widely publicized by this administration?
Well, they would, you know, Signal would be a competitor to WhatsApp, so that's not happening.
Well, however, as noted in a press release Wednesday, it will come in the form of glasses, as the brand has recently expanded into the sector of eyewear. Meta has been named the official AI glasses partner of the UFC. What a stranglehold on that section of the of marketing. Hoping to use their Meta glasses brand in a way that could, quote, blow away UFC fans, end quote, per CEO Dana White. The recent announcement is far from the first time Facebook has collaborated with the top promoter. Yes, there was back in the day you had to watch the prelims on Facebook. The first AI glasses partner of the UFC. It's funny because usually when I tune into UFC these days, I feel like I'm in an alternate reality. So why don't you just make the full transition by putting on those glasses?
Well, there's some of this happening already, right? There's some sort of virtual reality experience happening with UFC and Meta currently, correct? I've spoken about that before.
Yeah, they've experimented with various tools and such. But yes, this is our official agreement between the two. I believe they're also going to look at an AI upheaval of the UFC rankings somehow. Let's leave it to AI to.
Are you serious? They're going to do an AI rankings.
They're experimenting with this as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
They should also use
AI for fighter pay. Maybe we'll let artificial intelligence figure out what the value.
Depending on the answer,
are.
Sure. Yeah. Has it been mentioned that Dana White is a member of the board of Meta?
That is correct, yes. So, you know, he definitely had the inside track here as a member of the board of directors. So, this is what exciting stuff for the UFC and Meta coming together. Yes. Also, before we chat about this fan survey, we did want to talk about a report that came out from BJ Bethel of SE Scoops, this regarding the mysterious AEW Max streaming numbers. And this is what BJ Bethel reports. Again, this is up at sescoops.com. All Elite Wrestling is averaging around 500,000 viewers for its Wednesday Dynamite show on the Max streaming platform since the show debuted on the app this year, according to sources. Combined with live cable numbers, this would give Dynamite an average of around 1 to 1.2 million viewers per episode since it was added to the streaming service. According to sources, the show is averaging around 60 million minutes watched per show, with a deviation of plus minus 10 to 20%, depending on the episode and competition. Nielsen-style viewership numbers aren't necessarily important to streamers. The minutes watched averages to 500,000 viewers per episode. So break that down for us, Brandon. And, you know, these have been certainly, whenever we're talking about the AEW viewership, this is the big question mark, is what is the audience on Max? That generally, I would say that the AEW television viewership has held up very well 3 months into the move to Max, where conventional wisdom would be that these television figures would be dropping, especially among the younger audience.
Yeah, it's been pretty much what it's been. I mean, now there has been a decline, you know, before the new year, before this simulcast began, there had been a significant decline, as there has been for a couple of years here for AEW viewership. But it doesn't appear that there was instantly on January 1st when this started a significant cannibalization of AEW's viewership, because it's now available through a completely different means, which is Max streaming. This 500,000 is a lot, right? They're averaging just over 600,000 year to date for Dynamite. This is only what we're talking about here. This report doesn't touch on Collision, whatever Collision is doing, which is also being simulcast on Max. This would be almost doubling their viewership, which is a big surprise to me. I would look for other corroborating evidence that this number is accurate, whether it would be, you know, an increase in attendance or an increase in some other sort of fan engagement number. We don't see that yet. But the math of what's being put out here makes sense in terms of there being 60 million minutes watched. Fans of the Netflix to dumb are familiar with doing the math on the amount of time watched and dividing that by the duration of the show. So 60 million divided by 120, lo and behold, is about 500,000. That would be a lot. I did ask WBD if they would comment on this, knowing that Max streaming data is very secret information that they
did not
like.
Did they send you an Excel sheet with every week's breakdown?
They did not, unfortunately. But I did get a comment. It's amazing to get comments from people. Usually it's the partners of wrestling companies and not the wrestling companies themselves that give me comments. Well, they said that they couldn't comment on any actual viewership information for Max, but could say that Max has never released that kind of information either on or off the record, which is not a surprise to hear. That said, AEW Dynamite and Collision have been seeing meaningful upticks recently and hit multi-month highs on TBS and TNT with recent episodes, and the programs continue to rank well each week. Max's AEW audience is additive to that, both in terms of viewership of the live program as well as viewership of on-demand library content, and we are excited to continue to grow the AEW audience across their platforms. So a preview of the Tony Khan media call, perhaps, that's coming up tomorrow. I don't know. What do you think?
I would have enjoyed that statement if they said, you know, we haven't given out that information on the record, but we've definitely given it out off the record to many people. That would be something if they could so share.
I mean, the question is AEW even getting this data week to week or ever?
Yeah, and that would be a relevant question. And I guess the one that I would throw to you, if this information is under such like lock and key, if AEW is out there actively trying to secure advertising, if it's not getting these numbers, like how valuable are these numbers to AEW? Well, if it can't even verify what they are,
and I mean, it may just be a dynamic of like, you know, the SAG-AFTRA, they're not giving the actors their Netflix, their viewership numbers, because they don't want them to know. They don't want them to be able to fairly negotiate their value in terms of what they're delivering to the platform. So I could see that sort of line of thinking is like, if there's no Nielsen, that's going to, you know, make this information at least easier to access. It's not like there's a Nielsen website that we can all log into and get all the information that we want. We have nice resources like Program Insider, but I digress. It at least makes it harder for them to know what their real value is and negotiate more favorably for themselves.
Yeah. I would say like these numbers, and you know, BJ is a very good reporter. I think that if they're anywhere in this ballpark, like your 400,000 to 600,000 viewers, if we're talking that, I think that's a great number to be very happy about if you are AEW and you're getting that level of viewership on a weekly basis on top of your television audience.
Yeah. Like I said, I would like to see, and look, I've been a big, proponent of the notion that being on an additional platform, which it does significantly increase the reach. They're going from last year, 65 million homes to whatever the incremental amount is. It's probably, 10 million, maybe more than that extra homes now that they're in that they weren't in before because now they're on max. Could be a lot more than 10 million. But I would like to see an increase in attendance, which we're not seeing yet. I would like to see maybe an increase in whatever that information is about pay-per-view buys that we get that we're not seeing just yet. As I mentioned to you just before we came to air here, I've been told that there's some limited information that Nielsen does provide on a much delayed schedule, like a month delayed schedule about entertainment programs that are on streaming. Yes. I believe that's part of when you see, if you follow Nielsen on Twitter, like I do, you see their monthly posts of like, here's the most watched, TV shows on streaming of the previous month or something like that. So it may be coming out of that data source. And I would think that AEW, which is not, we've learned, is not necessarily overseen by Louis Silberwasser, who oversees TNT Sports or WBD Sports, whatever they call it now, but it's considered entertainment. So I wonder if it would be included in those data sets. If you have access to Nielsen data like that, feel free to let us know.
Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. That's chopped-tees.com/post-wrestling.
Well, we're going to stay on the subject of AEW, and we're about to figure out all of its problems and answer all of them in the next 20 minutes or so, because we have got the man who has conducted a pretty in-depth survey when it comes to AEW, its fan base, and what its habits have been over the past year. We welcome in Jesse Collings, who has conducted this AEW fan survey. Jesse, thank you so much for stopping by.
No, thanks for inviting me. I was thinking about, like, no one reads bland PR messages better than Brandon Thurston. There's probably a second career in that for you, Brandon.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've had a lot of practice in that.
Yeah, he puts a lot of feeling, especially into the big buzzwords. You got to emphasize those. It really captures the viewer. I think it's the Mark Shapiro effect that has just bestowed all of us when it comes to reciting some of what can be very dense language at times. But Jesse, you had to take a lot of answers and contribute them into a meaningful, digestible fashion. Before you talk about the results of this survey, you did a similar exercise a year ago. Can you tell us a little bit about what last year's survey kind of informed you on a grand scale and the desire to do a follow-up this year?
Well, last year's survey, I actually don't know how I came up with the idea, but I decided to do it last year, and I thought I would get like 40 to maybe 100 responses. So I formulated it very much based on like short answer responses, because I figured, hey, I'll only get, under 100 responses. So I'll be able to I really just wanted to read what people would say and then maybe turn that into like an article for voicesofwrestling.com. And I ended up getting like 1600 responses, which ended up being really cool because, man, I got so many responses and so much comments and things like that, but it was super unwieldy because I had all these short answer responses. And I think I shared the Google sheet that I had all the responses with Brandon. I was like, Brandon, can you make some sense out of this? Because this is just ridiculous. So Brandon had to pull like buzzwords and stuff. And
I was able to give you some like word clouds. I think I had tried to use the OpenAI API to make some sense of it, but that did not come to fruition.
Yeah. So that piece was really unwieldy. It was cool. And it was cool that I got some of my responses, but this year I was like, all right, I'm going to learn from that. I'm definitely going to use a lot more like, multiple choice and checklist style data to get an idea of what people got. So we didn't get nearly as many responses as we did last year. I'm going to chalk that almost entirely up to just the death of X as a prominent presence for a lot of people online, because I think that's where a lot of people found out about the survey last year. And now a lot of people are off X. But we did still get over 800 responses. And this year, I feel like I got a lot better information in terms of digestible what people think. And what I would say is that with, all right, 800 responses is obviously not, it's a very, very small sample size within the AEW fan audience. So I wouldn't really feel comfortable saying that the data we get from this survey is indicative of the wider AEW audience. But I do think that because it's almost entirely a group of very hardcore wrestling fans, this is insightful of what I think a specific group of hardcore, you know, close followers of professional wrestling and close followers of AEW think about the product. And I think that can be informative in its own way, even if we can't, it would probably be a mistake to generalize a lot of this information and use it as a broader context for all of AEW's fans.
One thing overall that I would just, again, this is kind of just going from my own sense of things, is that a year ago compared to today, if we actually go exactly a year ago, because I just saw this pop up online, it was CM Punk's interview in studio with Ariel Helwani, and shortly after that was the announcement that AEW is going to run the security footage on TV, and it just felt like this CM Punk cloud is never going to elude this company. And it does feel that at this point, it does feel like we are significantly in a post CM Punk AEW where that is not the predominant narrative attached to this company. Would you agree with that?
Did airing the footage work? Let's talk about that, because I thought it was a terrible idea at the time.
But I did too.
Ever since they aired that footage, that was kind of the end. I mean, they kind of tried to play it into an angle, but
it did a good quarter hour. People always want to point to, like, this was the moment where everything changed. There is, I don't think it's the cause, but there is a time that you know, the timing does coincide with an increase in the decrease of TV ratings for AEW.
Yeah, so I think, like, Trevor Dame once told me this on my podcast. He said that this is, you know, the CM Punk, the brawl out incident and everything associated with that has kind of is like AEW's version of the Montreal screw job, right? It's something that's just going to follow the company and the people that were involved in it around for the rest of their careers. And that's probably true to an extent. I'm sure in 20 years, if the Young Bucks are doing an interview, someone will bring up, you know, the brawl out incidents, right? But in the CM Punk press conference, but it's definitely feels like it's history, not the present in AEW. And I do think like I said this multiple times on my podcast when we went over the survey data. I definitely feel like this was a good time to do the survey. And if you're AEW, in terms of, I think fan optimism is a lot higher over the last month or 2 months than it has been in quite some time. So if you're AEW, this is probably a really good time to get set a positive feedback from your fan base. If this had been conducted maybe even four months ago, 3 months ago, it might've been a lot of a different story in terms of, I think a lot more fan resentment over different things.
Do you have what's your biggest takeaway from this? What did you learn?
I learned a lot. I would say the two things that stood out to me the most. The first was that, at least from the fans that we surveyed, of course, that there was almost 70% of fans said they had confidence in Tony Khan as the key decision maker within AEW, which
high approval rating.
Yeah, I thought it would be considered high because, 68.7% of fans said that they had confidence, and 15.8% of fans said they did not have confidence, and then the other 15% had no opinion. And I think if you I feel like the rhetoric that you see pretty much anywhere around Tony Khan seems to be negative, coming from pretty much all facets. So this was a reminder that I think, even if I feel like the day-to-day discussions about Tony Khan's leadership often takes a negative light, when fans take a step back and think about overall what has this guy done with this wrestling promotion, at least the group of fans that we surveyed seem to agree with that. And a lot of the short answer comments that I got that were after this question related to Tony Khan's leadership, which I asked the people who filled out the survey, why did you vote the way that you did? A lot of people, even the people that said that they didn't have confidence in Tony Khan, said that they still felt like, you know, his heart was in the right place. They liked that he was a fan of wrestling. They just felt like he was overwhelmed by too many, you know, having too many responsibilities, and that he needs to delegate more. There was very few of the respondents were like, Tony Khan's got to go. He's the problem. He's a major problem in this company right now. So that was surprising to me. And then the other thing that was surprising to me was, and again, we're getting into really small sample sizes here, but I had 65 respondents in the survey that said that they enjoyed WWE. And kind of looking at what their responses were to some of the questions compared to the voting body as a whole, there were some pretty significant differences in how they viewed the product. And I do think that is, again, it's dangerous to draw big conclusions, but I do think it's interesting to note that there does seem to be a difference between people that are kind of like enjoy the WWE product and how they feel about the AEW product and kind of everyone else that watches AEW.
Yeah, I think it's like one of the overarching problems that people have talking online about wrestling is that, well, is there something about us engaging in this way that makes our point of view so distorted compared to whatever this big mainstream fan view is? But something that did stand out to me is you mentioned people watching the video can see it here. You've got over 2/3 of this audience of this 801 people saying that they either don't watch or they are outright WWE haters. They dislike WWE. So, and I would say that that's different from what I visually saw when I went to an AEW event last some 10 months ago.
Yeah, and that's why I think, again, this is indicative of what a very hardcore subset of AEW fans think, not the general fan base. I'm kind of the belief that your average, maybe this is wrong, but your real average wrestling fan that you see at a live event has a relatively neutral opinion on AEW and WWE. Okay. They might like some things, they might dislike some things, but they kind of will watch either product if it happens to appeal to them.
And many of these people probably found this survey by clicking on it on Twitter, right? Where everyone is thrown against each other to fight.
Right. This was shared on social media. That's pretty much how everyone found it. I mean, and like I said, if you scroll down a little bit, you can see I asked what other promotions people watch. Okay, 70% of the people that filled this out said that they watched New Japan Pro Wrestling. That's obviously not indicative of the greater AEW audience. I think New Japan would love it if 70% of AEW fans were watching New Japan. I think they would probably have a nice TV deal in the United States if that was true. I think they'd be drawing really well in the United States when they run events here, but obviously that's not true. That's a small subset of hardcore fans. But
Chris Charlton might be citing the survey on Sakura Genesis this weekend.
Yeah, he might not want to be talking about AEW too much, but that could be it could be something that he indicates.
I found a lot of this interesting, one of which as we're kind of like just watching the week to week product, like it's typically, I think, like a very easy watch. I find that AEW, you've seen this shift over the last number of months where we've gone from a lot of those bigger venues that, you know, for such a long period of time, the atmosphere at these AEW shows had that party atmosphere that was such a big plus. And I think throughout a lot of 2024, the atmosphere was becoming a negative. And they've sort of found now this sweet spot of running a lot of aesthetically pleasing buildings. They're a lot more compact, and I think that is a small thing in all of this. However, one of your stats that came back here, and again, this is, you would assume, like a pretty hardcore audience, and yet there was a pretty significant portion of people, 23%, that said AEW came to their area, but they opted not to attend. And I found that one to be interesting, because if we're going to look at this as kind of more of a hardcore fan base, like that would be the audience that you would be thinking that AEW comes to town. It's not even a question that they would be attending these shows, and it's not an insignificant percentage that are opting not to go attend these shows.
John, I'm really glad you mentioned that, because that's definitely something that to me jumped out. Now, I don't work in live event promotion. I'm not a professional survey taker. So I honestly, like, again, this is all kind of amateurish analysis on my end, but I, like you, saw that figure, again, because we're talking about a real hardcore audience. I mean, 22% said that they traveled to an AEW live event. But if you have 23% of, like, hardcore wrestling fans that are not going to a show, and a lot of these people are people that like AEW, they're not making the decision to go to an AEW show that is near them. If I was Tony Khan and I saw that, I would think, well, that's unacceptable. We need to figure out why these people who are invested in pro wrestling and invested in our product to a degree are not coming to shows that are located near them. And there's a bunch of explanations for that. Is the product not as interesting to these fans? Is the live event promotion, the advertising, not really that great? Is there an issue where fans don't know who they're going to get on each show when the show is first announced? I mean, AEW has a pretty significant show coming to my area in Boston in a couple of weeks. And I don't know who's going to be on that show. I don't know what matches are going to be on that show. And that's coming in 2 weeks. I'm sure we'll find out, you know, in the week leading up to it, what's going to be on Dynamite on Wednesday and their Collision taping on Thursday. But I am not like, I don't know who's going to be on the shows. I can look at the poster as, you know, it's shown right now on the screen. Like, okay, it looks like, you know, Mercedes Moné is probably going to be there because she's from Boston. It looks like Kenny's going to be there. Is Kenny going to be wrestling? Like, is Will Ospreay going to be there? Like, what's going to be on the show? I don't know. And that's like a kind of like a, it's a named Dynamite. It's not like your typical Dynamite or your typical Collision. So I think that's probably a reason. But
that's a number that long-term booking.
What was that?
You're asking for long-term booking.
I'm asking for like promotion. Now, this is an advantage WWE has, I think, in the brand split, right? Which it's gotten a little fuzzy as we get to build up to WrestleMania like it does every year. But one of the good things about the brand split is that if Raw is coming to your town, you know who is going to be on Raw. And you know if SmackDown is coming, who is going to be on SmackDown. Now, maybe there's booking reasons or something why a big star isn't there that week. But you have a pretty solid idea that if SmackDown is coming, you're going to see, you know, whatever bloodline angle they're going to do, and you're going to see Cody Rhodes. You're going to see these people. And if Raw is coming, you're going to see CM Punk, and you're going to see Seth Rollins. And AEW, because they don't have a brand split, and because they have a really wide roster of people, you really don't know what you're going to get until, like, the day of the show.
When you look at the results, when it comes to one of the questions you asked about how long you've been watching AEW, and there was about like 31 people, I think it was, that had stated that they fell into AEW just over the past year. And I'm curious to you, like, what would you attribute factors that AEW is actively doing, whether it's, you know, wider distribution on Max, or even for yourself, Jesse, when you fall into like a show on Netflix or something, like what are the things that are pulling people towards even finding AEW at this point? Is there enough of that promotion that goes outside of your wrestling bubble and good week to week shows, like in terms of just creating new fans? I know it's not an easy question, because if people had the answer, it'd be certainly demonstrated a lot more. But I always find that interesting for both companies when it comes to bringing people into this, where it's a big ask if you want to like absorb this, and we're asking you to watch all these hours of television every week and dive into this. Like, what are those methods to finding new fans?
I'm really, again, really small sample size, right? Only 31 people out of this survey. I'm really fascinated by the 31 people who said they've watched AEW in the past year and also found this survey. I said that I would like to have like a roundtable discussion with all of them. I would probably need like a Dr. Strangelove, like war room roundtable to fit all the people on it. But I'm really fascinated by what they have to say, just because, for the exact same reason, John, because, you know, as people that have been in following the wrestling industry closely, like all of us here have been, for years and years, it's kind of hard to relate to. There's my roundtable that I'm going to have.
Yeah, this is Jesse's next podcast.
Yes. Yeah, several of the people are going to be Peter Sellers too. That'd be awesome. But we're going to, you have, like you, when you're in it as deep as we are, and as probably a lot of the people that are listening to the show are, it's kind of hard to relate to someone that knows extremely little about professional wrestling. I went to a indie show with my roommate a month ago, and she like knew nothing about professional wrestling, but she was just kind of, oh, it's something I've never been to before, so I want to try it. And so I was there and like having to try to explain to her, like, you know, this is what it is. No, like she knew it was fake, but she didn't know like how it was fake. And it was like, I'm sure other people have had this interaction before.
Jesse, what promotion was it?
This was Chaotic Wrestling. Okay. Which is kind of like they actually had like a really good, I mean, they had like probably like 300 or 400 people there. trying to think who were the Anthony Green was there. Who else was like there? That was some of the WWE ID talent was there too as well.
You should have been handing out surveys at the show, mail-in ballots.
I know that would be interesting too. And I, you know, it was interesting was seeing going to an indie show and seeing kind of what the crowd was like there and how different it was from indie shows like 10 years ago. I think there was a lot more like NXT kind of WWE fans there than there were like 10 years ago, which were a lot more like Bullet Club shirt wearing fans. But I'm fascinated by the people that said that they came into wrestling. I saw some of the results from the short answers that some people said. Someone said that, you know, I had never watched pro wrestling before I first started watching AEW. And this is what I think of the product. And this is why I'm engaged. I would say that, again, really small sample size, women's wrestling. And I think the kind of artistic niche that it has is a way to bring in fans that maybe otherwise would not be traditional pro wrestling fans, not people that would be maybe super into like Stone Cold Steve Austin chugging beers and giving stunners, like how a lot of wrestling fans first started watching wrestling, or like, you know, these super high work rate indie matches. I do think that women's wrestling in like the Toni Storm character, whether you like it or not, I do think it can bring a different type of person into the world of professional wrestling. And that maybe is an audience that AEW wants to target, as opposed to, you know, nostalgic fans, nostalgic for a previous era of professional wrestling that no longer exists, or some WWE fans to start sampling the product a little bit more. I do think that is a potential avenue. I did see that, at least from the limited number of people that responded that were new fans, that women's wrestling in general was something that they were really interested in.
I've always been fascinated since I saw like All Japan Women in the 80s, not in real time, and just heard those crowds scream and like the teenage girls of up by the thousands in the Budokan scream, and you can't help but think, well, could something like this be reproduced today?
Well, and what happened to those fans, right?
Like, well, they forced the talent to retire for one thing at age 26. Yeah.
Yeah, and certainly, and I think this is when we talked about like, it's also like this kind of conflict amongst AEW fans. And one of the issues with AEW since the company first started was that when it first became announced, every fan kind of inherently put expectations on AEW to be the company that represents what they personally feel like was missing in pro wrestling. And I think a heavy emphasis, not just on women's wrestling, but like a presentation of pro wrestling that might cater more towards female viewers, with the way some characters like the Toni Storm character are presented, the way some drama is orchestrated on the show, that might be in opposition to your hardcore wrestling fan that wants to see, you know, this, you know, high work rate or 1980s territory style professional wrestling presentation. And that's always an issue with AEW. I think you have a lot, it's a big tent of a lot of diverse types of wrestling fans, and it's hard to satisfy all of them. And when you do start doing things a little bit differently, you start hearing from the vocal group of fans that are in opposition to something that's going on.
Do you think that those areas have shrunk over the years in terms of differentiating itself from a WWE that is generally, I think, satisfying its fan base further? And if you agree with that, what are, do you feel, areas AEW still can rely on that it can do significantly better than its opposition?
Yeah, I think in-ring wrestling is the key to AEW. It has been since the company first started. And while I am wary of drawing big conclusions from this survey, one of the things that I felt was really relevant in the survey was basically every single person that filled out the survey said that they enjoyed the in-ring wrestling for AEW. When I asked, you know, in the general consensus, when I asked, you know, what did you like about AEW, 98.4% of fans said the in-ring wrestling. And that's true across any subgroup of fans you want to pull from this. Even the WWE fans said it was 91% of them liked the in-ring wrestling. And amongst new fans, it was 100%. All 31 of them said that they enjoyed the in-ring wrestling. So that is always, that has been the strength of the promotion since the company first started. That will continue to probably be the strength of the promotion. And if I was Tony Khan and I was someone in AEW, I think that would always be top of mind, that we are a in-ring wrestling promotion. And that has to be what our company is about. That is what our fan bases want. It's also something that I think they have a significant edge over WWE and pretty much any other American professional wrestling company. And that is a way for the company to stand out. And it's a way it's what your audience wants. I don't think they need more video packages. I don't think that they need more promo segments or opening a show with a long promo segments or these really character heavy driven storyline angles that can sometimes be cheesy, like the Bro Chacho stuff. A lot of things that people have said that the company has needed, I would suggest that that's really not necessary, because this is ultimately a company that is about what happens when that bell rings. And I would try to cater my product as much as possible to being about that.
And what's happening with the merchandise? This is something that's come up many times over the years, but just a lack of selection about the merchandise. Cause you have this question here too, about what fans dislike, which I'll show them.
Yeah. It's kind of funny because, again, one thing all fans agree on, again, across, if all fans agree on that the in-ring wrestling is good, all fans agree on that the merchandise is not good. And I've heard this, and I'm sure you have, Brandon, and I'm sure you have too, John, that the merchandise has been a problem with AEW since the company first started. I think there's been issues at live events. You go to a live event, they only have a couple of merchandise. It runs out quickly. Everything feels kind of generic. But a consistent.
This is all operated through a partnership with Pro Wrestling Tees, both online and at the venue.
Yes. And a consistent issue that I've heard from people saying is that I don't want to wear a wrestling shirt that I can't wear anywhere else in public without feeling like I'm wearing something that's really strange and really weird. So maybe this is different from the AEW fan base than the WWE fan base. I don't know, but I think the AEW fan is a little bit more self-conscious about what they're wearing. And they don't necessarily want to wear a shirt that screams, "I watch wrestling." So maybe there's shame there involved. I have no idea. And I'm not someone that's like crazy about wrestling merch. I don't know. I'm not probably not the best person to analyze this because I don't really buy any wrestling merch all that much. But if you look at the shirts that they have for sale, just like what's being shown on the video screen right here, I don't know. I see a lot of really big graphics and a lot of really big pictures of wrestlers, and maybe that's not what people want. Also, a lot of black shirts.
Yeah, a lot of black. I remember leaving the very first All In and just seeing like just this sea of like it was like this march of the black t-shirts, and it was just thousands of people in these black t-shirts. I'm like, this is a cult to a certain degree. Any sort of messages you took away from the questions you asked about who fans viewed as the most popular and also the ones they disliked the most? Did it tell you any overarching message about the talent that it is promoting and the talent that it's signing in terms of what the reaction was?
People want new stars and people want younger wrestlers. If you look at this list that, again, and I have... This is really fun because I have the data for every single one of the people that responded. So I have like, I know who got 22 votes and things like that, or someone who got one vote. But basically I had a list of the entire AEW roster and said, check off no more than 10 of your favorite wrestlers in AEW. And Adam Page was the most popular. He was on the highest percentage of ballots. I think he was on something like almost 70% of ballots.
Over 600 here, yeah.
Yeah, and he's followed by. But you look at this top 10, right? Adam Page, Kenny Omega, Will Ospreay, Swerve, Tony Storm, Konosuke Takeshita, Willow Nightingale, Eddie Kingston, Brian Danielson, Orange Cassidy.
No MJF on either of your lists of who you like or dislike.
Nope, MJF. Yeah, he was right outside the top 10. I think he was 11th in most or 11th in most popular and 12th in least popular.
Is that just a result of being a heel, even though he's one of their top stars?
I'm not sure. I mean. I don't know why I expected him to be in least popular because he certainly seems to be one of the wrestlers that fans seem to complain the most about. But I want to get to least popular in a second. But most popular, what we have here when you look at these lists are, with the exception of Kenny Omega and the exception of Brian Danielson, we either have wrestlers that are pretty young that are, you know, under the age of 40. A lot of them are under the age of 35. And even in the exception of a wrestler like Orange Cassidy or Eddie Kingston, people that haven't necessarily been on television for decades. And those are the wrestlers that fans really seem to respond to. And this is a growing thing that I've noticed with you watch AEW on television or you go to a live event and the fans just really get tend to really get behind not necessarily the biggest stars in the company, but some of the newest stars in the company, like Brody King. He gets great reactions from the crowd when he comes out. And I think that there's a lot, like he, I think he wrestled, there was a match he had against Okada where Brody King was getting far better reactions from the audience than Okada, who's coming in as this huge star and getting this big push and all this stuff like that. And it did make me think about AEW has a lot of really promising, talented people that haven't been on TV and haven't been exposed forever. And the company really needs to focus on pushing those talents. And that hasn't really been the case in certain examples. It's certainly not the case around the world title in the recent Moxley and Copeland feud, because those are two guys that have been on television for decades. But my takeaway was that on one hand, it's a good thing that AEW seems its most popular wrestlers are young people on the come up that AEW should theoretically have on the roster for years and years. And on the flip side, it's kind of a negative in the sense of it's you don't have Jon Moxley who's been the world champion for 6 or 7 months isn't one of your most popular wrestlers, or Adam Copeland who was in a really long feud for the world title isn't one of your most popular wrestlers, nor is Mercedes Moné, nor is Kazuchika Okada. So these really high priced people that you're bringing in and pushing a lot are not necessarily resonating as much as some of these other wrestlers are.
And why did you leave Billy Gunn and Cope off of this most popular wrestlers list?
Yeah, I had to throw out the Billy Gunn results because he got 100% of the vote. So, you know, it's kind of like one of those suspicious things that you don't know. But when we talk about the least popular, what's the big thing with the least popular wrestlers is people don't like old talent.
These are just people who have heel heat, though, right?
They're ageist.
Yeah, they're getting that kind of good heat. There's some noise here. I would look at the Camille results and I'd be like, I think Camille is getting those votes for a different reason necessarily than like her on-screen performance. I don't think that's really a part of that. I honestly don't know, but other people have told me that she has some political views that that are unpopular, which I was completely unaware of, but makes sense.
I mean, maybe they are popular, but divisive. Yes.
Yeah. Not popular with the fans who filled out the survey. But you look at, okay, Chris Jericho, he is the Michael Jordan of this category. He'll be winning this category, I think, for as long as he's in the company. And then you have Britt Baker, and then you have Adam Copeland, you have Billy Gunn, you have Jeff Jarrett sneaking on here. Even like I noticed Dustin Rhodes got 28 votes, which I was like kind of really surprised. But I was like, come on, who hates Dustin Rhodes? Who like all he does, like he seems to be a pretty benign character, like. Who's voting out there that hates Dustin Rhodes? But there are people that are just like, I don't want to see any old people on my television. I want this to be a new, fresh, exciting company. And I think that's
Baker being number two here is a surprise to me.
Yeah, I don't really know what to make of that. I know that she is there's a lot of people that don't like her, I guess, is how I would say it. I personally have never really understood it the way – like I kind of like Jericho, but I also really understand why he ranks so highly on here for a number of different reasons.
Is this like people, you know, reading backstage drama reports and there's something with MJF?
I think that's definitely a factor, Brandon. I also think that maybe some people just – they have a personality that – people find grating. I mean, this is kind of like, again, like I have for the,
no one likes going to the dentist after all.
It's true. People don't like their dentist. People don't like going to the dentist. I was at the dentist on a Monday. Mm. And I was not having a good time. I think I was on the Muda scale with how much I was bleeding, but
did they tell you that you have to floss?
They asked me if I floss. I said, no, I use a water pick. And they're like, well, you also have to floss. So, yeah. Yes.
It's also interesting here. Like half these people that we're looking at that the audience like dislikes, they're either off television in like purgatory mm-hmm. or they've been exiled to ROH in the case of like a Sammy Guevara. So it's like we're not even talking about people that are actively eating up minutes anymore. Like Jeff Jarrett, there was certainly that, you know, you have the pro and con of Jeff Jarrett. I think there's a certain I think after that Owen promo last year, I think that got a lot of momentum behind Jarrett. But he was just programmed so heavily, and then boom, they just pulled him out and is not representative on television at all right now.
The
exception being Jericho is someone who is, you know, he's all over programming.
If I was AEW and I looked at this, I would say like, oh, this is a good thing that a lot of the people that our fans dislike the most are not currently major parts of our product. Like if Mox was number one, and that would be like a bigger problem to me if I was AEW. But if you look at this and it's like a lot of talent that has been de-emphasized or has been, in the case of like Danhausen, like, you know, gotten, you know, is lost and missing. I would feel that that's a good thing that like, we're not, that these are largely people that don't have a huge impact on our product on a week to week basis, with the exception of really Jericho and Copeland. The rest, and I guess Adam Cole, to an extent. But I would consider that to be a positive that these are the wrestlers that fans dislike are not being heavily featured on my product.
How would you assess sort of the talent acquisition process for a Tony Khan if someone of value becomes available from WWE? Certainly, like you're looking at a certain scale where there's a value. And then like Bobby Lashley is a perfect example. Here was a push guy in WWE. But at the same time, it's like you're weighing this with, I think this is a pretty indicative reaction of a lot of the audience, that I think you can make your cases for some of these talents, but when you have such a plethora of them, you do risk, I think, kind of, you know, making that a part of your identity. And what is the value versus what is the risk of signing some of these ex-WWE talent and the value that they bring to your company?
I think when we talk about risk, that's a really good word to use, John, because I think when we talk about risk with the signing guy, when signing an ex-WWE talent, like the typical risk that people associate with you taking on signing like a Bobby Lashley, who's like, you know, an older veteran wrestler, is that what if they are really bad? What if they don't connect with our audience? What if they don't put in a great effort? They're just looking for a payday. What if all of this stuff happens? People think about it from a real like negative performance perspective. But part of the risk you're taking when you sign a guy like Bobby Lashley is that you are you're kind of, the risk is that you're pushing someone on television who has already been on television for 20 years that kind of we all kind of know has a ceiling, and they're going to be taking up time from a promising younger talent. Now, not every younger talent is going to be worthy of getting a significant amount of television time. But part of the issue is when you keep bringing in just more and more and more people, some talented people or some young prospects aren't going to get the time they need to develop. And you're kind of wasting that opportunity by going with somebody that has kind of a finite ceiling on how popular, how successful they can be in the company. And you can see it. There's plenty of talents in AEW that I think have flashed a lot of potential at some point, but have seen their careers get really stagnant in large part because they haven't been given consistent time on television or creative attention, because you constantly have Kazuchika Okada or Bobby Lashley or Adam Copeland or these other people coming in. Even someone like Will Ospreay, who is a younger wrestler that's definitely, I think we would all agree, is worth investing and pushing. But you bring him in and then, okay, where does that leave a Daniel Garcia? Where does that leave a Jack Perry or this other project that we've been trying to keep for a long time and trying to push? It does become the risk is not just, we're going to sign this guy and we hope that he's good. The risk is we're going to sign this person and they're going to be taking up time that could be spent elsewhere.
Isn't that a product of signing too many wrestlers?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think sometimes we think about it too much in the vein of like, you're signing talent and you have too much talent, and like, there's too many ex-WW guys. There's, you know, it sends the wrong message that this is just a landing ground for anyone that flames out of WWE or washed up veterans getting one more payday. But I think there's another element to it that is really important, which is that a lot of the veterans from WWE that AEW have signed have been good. Like, I think Adam Copeland as a performer has done a really solid job in terms of what he's performed doing in AEW.
Clearly wants to be there. I mean, that's very evident. Yep.
He's putting in a really, I think, a good effort. I think some of the stuff with the Mox angle didn't really connect, but overall, I would say that he is a plus asset to the company from performance perspective, but you're also paying the price of making this guy who has a very, I think, a defined ceiling in terms of what he can mean for your company in terms of drawing power, in terms of star power, in terms of all of this other stuff. And you're taking away opportunities that could be reflected with other wrestlers. And I think that's where a lot of the resentment of older wrestlers comes from. I don't think that there are people that necessarily hate, there's not 30 people that hate Dustin Rhodes, but they see him like, okay, that's a mid-card role that maybe another wrestler that could have that's not in his 50s. And I think that's something a lot of fans feel.
I think there's something connected in that. I think we talked about over the years that you could look back at the kicking off of most big booms in wrestling or territories getting set on fire. And it's usually, with the exception of like Hulk Hogan turning heel, it's usually coinciding with a new star who's being pushed to the main event for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's Okada, New Japan, Austin, and WWF.
Or especially if you want to go back to the territories era, or even using the NWO, which is a good example, new stars coming into the territory, right? Hulk Hogan turned heel, but he also had the Outsiders there, and you had these people that were doing things a little bit differently. Obviously, when the WWF took up for the first time, you had a bunch of new people coming into the promotion. So I always, the lifeblood of wrestling is realistically always new, looking for new stars and trying to find the next new stars. And I think from a war chest perspective, AEW has a really great collection of promising talents that they can continue to push to the top level. I think far better than what WWE has. If you look at the WWE men's roster, it's almost, in terms of guys who get significant pushes, it's almost entirely wrestlers that have 20 plus years of experience. I think if you look at the top matches at WrestleMania, Roman Reigns is the greenest wrestler that they have in terms of who they're pushing. And that's to get back to a previous point you said, John, pushing new wrestlers that people haven't seen on TV forever is also something that AEW could maybe have an advantage of currently.
The entire survey and all of its results, complete with graphs, can be read over at voicesofwrestling.com. Besides myself and Brandon, I hope this survey makes the rounds and all wrestling podcasters and end up breaking this down. I would love to know the insights of other people in the industry to go through this survey with you, Jesse. But this is a really great exercise on your part. I hope you continue to do some of these surveys. Maybe next you will tackle a WWE survey to get the vibes of, as you've dubbed it, Shakespeare in the Park with the Bloodline segments.
Yeah, no, thanks. And I also, me and Adam Berger broke down the survey on my podcast, the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast. So if you hate reading and don't want to look at all the data yourself, that's also available anywhere you can get your podcasts if you want to listen to further analysis of that.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Jesse, to go through all of the results, and we'll definitely chat with you soon. And enjoy Boston if you do make it to. Have you ever gone to that venue that AEW is running for any concerts or anything? Do you know anything?
So no. So that's a pretty new venue that they opened up a year or two ago. It's literally inside Fenway Park. It is not Fenway Park itself, but it's it's probably 3,500 to 4,000 seat venue. I think my parents went to go see Sting from the
Wrestler.
Yeah, they went to go see Sting. So they went to go. I think they saw Sting there. So it's kind of a new concert venue. I have never been in there, but it is in line with kind of what you said, John, which is they're running these different kind of aesthetically different venues because they've run in Boston. They've run two venues before. They ran the Aganis Arena, which is a pretty standard, mid-sized, I don't know, it's 5,000 or 6,000 seats basketball ice hockey rink on the campus of Boston University. And they've run the TD Garden, which is, you know, where the Celtics and the Bruins play. So they've kind of been in traditional buildings. It's very interesting that they chose this building because they could go to the – they probably wouldn't want to go to the TD Garden again because unless they had something really spectacular, they probably wouldn't draw that well. But they could have easily gone back to the Aganis and done, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 people or whatever for this show. The fact that they're choosing to go to a slightly smaller venue that has a different vibe is I think, notable. And that's something I can at least see from a local level. I'm sure some of these other buildings that they've been in other parts and other cities they've been to is also interesting.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Jesse, for stopping by. This has been a really interesting chat and the discussion. I enjoyed really listening to you and Adam break this all down and going through the survey. So thanks for coming on.
Thanks.
All right. That was Jesse Collings joining us. Again, you can check out the survey results over at voicesofwrestling.com. And final couple of minutes here. Let's go through just a couple of the viewership results from the past couple of days. SmackDown on Friday night up against the NCAA basketball tournament. 1,350,000 viewers on the USA Network, down 7.5%, and a 0.4 in the demo, which was up slightly from a 0.39 the week before. This all this was a taped show from London, so on a several-hour tape delay, all leading to the big contract signing with Roman Reigns, Seth Rollins, and with a tear in his eye, CM Punk, as he was granted his WrestleMania main event through Section 4, Clause 3 of the contract that he signed.
Yeah, the March Madness numbers have been really, really big. I looked at the Saturday numbers and I tweeted those. I mean, you got a Duke, I think Alabama game that did a combined 9 million viewers. So you can chalk that up to this week. You would think that in the run-up to WrestleMania, you'd be seeing stronger numbers, which we often do. But yeah, this was their lowest in quite some time. This might have been their lowest. Was this their lowest on USA since the USA run? No, it wasn't. There's one other that was lower, at least. Maybe a couple.
Yeah. And if you recall, this was sort of the thinking that that Nick Khan had stated before about pushing WrestleMania to later in April, avoiding the NCAA tournament. Like, often they'd be going up against like the final weekend of the tournament, and then that Raw would go against the final game. So they're avoiding that altogether. Saturday's collision up against the NCAA, 339,000 viewers and a 0.09. Obviously, this was down huge from the previous week when they aired late that night with the lead-in from the NCAA. So they were down like 40% in viewers, which was to be expected. And finally, our Ta-Dum segment of the week, Raw, on March 24th, generating 3 million views and 5.6 million hours viewed. You know, it says here, an hour and 44 runtime. I definitely have to watch a lot more than an hour and 44 minutes of Raw each week. So, man, that has to be the shortest edited down Raw that they have listed to date on Netflix. But yeah, ranking fourth globally. Yeah. Third in the U.S., sixth in Canada, among the 22 countries where it ranked in the top 10.
Pretty normal number for the numbers that we've gotten so far. Did get as low as 2.6 million on February 24th, but now it's just been hovering at 3 million, 3.1 million for the last several weeks. As we discussed at the beginning here, this data is probably about to get messed up in a big way, beginning with the introduction of the Indian market. And I understand Pakistan has been added too, I saw. So as this international Netflix deal becomes complete in terms of all the regions getting on board, it's going to get a little distorted. But I'll try to make sense of it and try to continue to make these estimates that, according to my estimates, put it right on par with what Raw was doing in the U.S. on the USA Network in terms of how many people are watching it in the U.S. On Netflix, right on par with where it was last year.
Yeah, and even Friday's SmackDown, it was in the top 10 in 10 different countries, including the UK and Canada. And definitely we've seen this is applied to Raw and SmackDown, like these European shows. It just seems it is ranked across a wider amount of countries just with the earlier start time that you would assume.
Yeah, people watching it live probably, yeah.
My own correction here, so thank you to those in the comments, that All In Texas is listed for an afternoon start time, so it would not collide with Saturday night's main event, which is a new detail there, because originally this was to be a night show, so in theory they will not be going against Saturday night's main event, but still same day.
Will Saturday night's main event be just happening to be airing earlier?
Maybe it'll be Saturday afternoon's main event. You know what? NBC might have a very
It'll be a four-hour pre-show. Four-hour pre-show to Saturday night's main event, maybe.
We have a super chat from Jake from the Windy City speculating here, but with Dana White involved with PowerSlap, now this new boxing group with TKO, is this a sign he would like to move on from the UFC? I mean, if you take his word, you know, he had stated that this year was going to be the test of how much he is able to do and if he's going to relinquish any of his duties at the UFC. We will see. I mean, PowerSlap is his major hobby, and like the boxing deal, like that's going to be a full-time gig right there. I mean, he's definitely into Tony Khan levels of involvement now in all of this. I don't know what being on the board of directors for Meta requires on a weekly basis for him, but he's got that going too. He's executive producing now a movie with Turki Alalshikh, so he's very busy.
A movie about what?
It's called Brawler. They have enlisted Zack Snyder to direct this film about a fighter down on his fortunes who rises up to become a UFC champion. Does that sound like a movie that you would want to go pay money to see?
No, but I rarely pay money to see movies. So.
Well, that's for everyone to look forward to at a future date. You know, Dana White has, there's quite the machine that runs the UFC at this point. Dana, I think they want to be the focal public face of the company. And I think they will want to continue that. But yeah, it is interesting just to see Dana involved in so many other things. And I mean, his initial interest was always boxing. I can see him very much diving headfirst into this boxing promotion that they're launching this year and being heavily tied into that. I mean, the UFC kind of runs on clockwork at this point in time that I think he could relinquish a lot of his duties. And I don't think UFC is going to be all that out of sorts without Dana White on a day-to-day basis, but we'll see what this year provides for one Dana White. All right. Well, there you go.
You sent me before we leave, you sent me a link to an eBay product. Would you like to, let me show that.
Well, we were having the discussion with Jesse about how wrestling fans will wear almost anything in public, and
this is available on eBay.
I think this was the absolute lowest rock bottom.
Is this a gift that is a gift idea for you for upcoming holidays?
Definitely not. If you ever purchased this shirt and wore it, I definitely think differently of you.
The title of this shirt is Vince McMahon Loves Rooster DX Degeneration X Men's Black T-Shirt. Available on eBay now for $27.99.
Yes. I don't think Rooster was the particular description they were going for.
That's what it says right here. It says Rooster.
Yeah. That's it. That's probably to get around eBay regulations, but yeah. Very classy company. That will wrap things up for us. Again, a thank you to Jesse Collings for joining us. And you can follow all of Brandon's work over at WrestleNomics.com, Patreon.com/WrestleNomics, as well as supporting him on Substack. And he has always got the state of the industry coming your way to figure out what is happening in the business world. And more importantly, how is John Cena's European line of clothing selling? We got to get some European merch numbers. Yeah.
I have a script that goes through every single day and checks what are the top listed items on W Shop and AW Shop and Pro Wrestling Tees, and then we publish that every month. So we got the monthly update that just went up today. And the big winners, if these lists are honest, take them for what they're worth. John Cena and over in AW, you got two shirts for Hangman and Adam Page, number one and number two. So consistent.
So the heel turn is not going to affect his royalty checks, is what you're telling us.
It doesn't look like it so far. I mean, it could always be greater if he was a face. You could always have that theory.
That is true itself. Have you come to a conclusion on any travel plans in the month of April? Are you
no definitive final answer has been made, but we're leaning towards no, I think.
Okay. Well, you have to break the news here if you are going or not. But
I have until I have a week notice that I have to cancel my hotel by, so I'm probably waiting until the last minute.
Thursday, Tony Khan is going to be hosting a media call ahead of Dynasty, which is happening this Sunday. So any news and notes coming out of that, we will be talking about later this week. And you can follow all of my work over at postwrestling.com. Wei Ting and I, we just put out the latest Rewind Away up at postwrestlingcafe.com covering SummerSlam 1997, featuring Bret Hart versus The Undertaker, Steve Austin's neck injury, Governor Christine Todd Whitman, who removed the the entertainment tax to allow WWF to run a televised event in the state of New Jersey, and got her own segment on WWF programming, and one of the worst contest giveaways in company history, as they promoted all summer long, giving away $1 million, and there were no winners at the end of it. So that was SummerSlam 97 in a nutshell. Check out all of that, and then I'm back tonight with Wei Ting right after Dynamite from Peoria, Illinois. They're doing a double taping tonight of Dynamite and Collision. So Brandon will be watching NCAA basketball, but I know he'll have probably Dynamite on, maybe on a second screen.
Are there any good games on tonight? This is the Final Four? Not yet? I don't know. Who knows? But I turn it on the TV.
Yeah, you can keep me up to date on NCAA, and I can tell you about the Japanese Grand Prix this Sunday as Yuki Tsunoda becomes the number two driver for Red Bull. It's a huge race this weekend for Red Bull. But that's it for us. Thanks to everyone for tuning in. We'll be back next Wednesday, 1 Eastern, on all your WrestleNomics post-wrestling feeds. Goodbye. This month at postwrestlingcafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. Postwrestlingcafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.